This is the Education Gadfly Show.
In terms of explaining how those organs... Yeah, right.
Frog's legs with garlic butter. Really good.
Yes.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the original Education Gadfly, Checker Finn.
Humbug. I've decided that's a better term than gadfly.
Uh-huh. Well, it's still in the insect family, so it's
we're
okay.
Keeping it in the arachnids or whatever they are.
Checker's been a while. Have you been to all four corners of the globe since we last spoke?
Five. We've grown the globe. Nice. And turned it into a pentagon.
Yes. You're sailing the seven seas. It's coming up, I understand. The Baltic this summer?
The Baltic this summer and the Black Sea in the autumn.
Yeah. Nice. Are these places actually enjoyable to visit? I mean, do you try to go to places that are actually nice to visit, or are you just determined to go everywhere?
Neither.
I mean, so for example, if somebody said, let's imagine, well, I shouldn't name cities. I was gonna say, like, if you hadn't been to, say, Toledo, Ohio, and some people think Toledo is maybe not the nicest place ever, would you go there just because you want to say you've been there?
No, I'm interested in places that are different and seeing what makes them tick and how they're different. Some of them are nice. Some of them in the sort of conventional, you know, comfy, pretty, nice climate, nice food sense. Others are just plain interesting. Former sites of the Gulag in eastern Russia. But you want to see it, even if you aren't going to want to eat there.
Mm. You know, my biggest tourism mistake I ever took, I think, is going to the torture museum in Cambodia. That's
yes.
One I could have skipped.
But the best tourism decision you ever made was to follow my advice and go around the world with your bride.
That is true. Okay, now let's cover. We got lots to cover, Checker, even though things are slowing down a tad in the education policy
world. Doesn't look like it to me.
But there are still big debates to be had. So let's do it, Ty. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
This week, the Government Accountability Office released a report finding that charters enroll a smaller percentage of students with disabilities than traditional public schools. Is this a problem? And if so, what must charters do about it?
No, it's not a problem. It would be a problem if charters were overtly discriminating against disabled kids, just as it would be if they were overtly discriminating against girls or tall kids or Catholic kids. But charters aren't meant to be all things to all kids. They're meant to be special. They're meant to be different. Not everybody applies to them. Not everybody is going to be happy with the program there. And a charter school with 250 kids in it is not meant to cater to every individual idiosyncrasy of every student who might think of coming there.
And Checker, this is a point that everybody overlooks, is that no single public school is expected to serve every type of student with every type of disability. I mean, you look at any school system of any size, and they specialize. They say, we're going to have an autism program over here in this elementary school, and we're going to have something over here for kids with intellectual disabilities over here. They aren't expected to be equipped to handle every single kind of disability that might come through the door.
Actually, it would be idiotic to expect them to try, because some kids need really specialized equipment and staffing and ambulatory arrangements and things like that. When I was a professor at Vanderbilt a million years ago, Nashville had an entire school, separate school for kids with severe disabilities. And 100% of the kids in that school were disabled. Kids with severe disabilities were not in other Nashville schools.
You know, the other thing that's tricky about these numbers is we know, for example, that some states identify half as many kids as other states in terms of kids with disabilities. So Texas, half as many as Massachusetts, about. Does that mean that we think the Republic of Texas is discriminating against all these special ed kids who deserve services?
Well, an equally plausible theory is that Massachusetts is... being absurd in its definition of what's a disability.
Right. So it could be that these charter schools are, instead of labeling kids who are marginally disabled, have mild disabilities, they're saying, we're not going to put a label on you. We have a program that's going to serve you well. And their parents agree because they're choosing the school.
A lot of charter schools that I know and like claim that they individualize the program for every student in the school. And therefore, why should they bother giving a kid an IEP label when everybody is getting an individualized program?
Okay, topic number two.
On Friday, President Obama announced his administration would no longer deport young undocumented immigrants if they attend school and meet other requirements. What does this mean for education, and how does it compare to the president's approach to NCLB?
Well, you know, people have been drawing some comparisons here. There are many of concerns on the right that this is unconstitutional, the president just deciding not to enforce the nation's laws. Some people are, you can also see that he is doing this on No Child Left Behind, not so much just through the waiver process, but he's actually said that there are parts of the law that he is going to not enforce while states are applying for the waivers. So, for example, the highly qualified teacher provision that states can basically say, ask for a certain waiver from that, and the government saying we won't enforce that provision. What makes me wonder, Checker, is for all the uproar on the right, if Mitt Romney were to be elected president, wouldn't it be attractive for him to decide to non-enforce the big parts of No Child Left Behind that Republicans on Capitol Hill and that he himself say are no longer worth doing?
Or to persuade the Congress to undo those provisions of the law through the normal reauthorization process. I mean, both of these examples have me about as torn as anything I can remember, because in both cases, the constitutional question is legitimate. Does the executive branch have the license to do these make these changes unilaterally without congressional assent? At the same time, the Congress has proven itself totally dysfunctional, both on reauthorization of No Child Left Behind and on immigration reform. Into this paralysis, the executive branch has stepped, probably with authority that it doesn't possess, to solve a problem that needs solving. And in both cases, I happen to agree with the Obama end that they are seeking, with the non-enforcement that they are engaged in. I'm troubled by the mechanism. I wish Congress would fix it, but I really do believe that these Dream Act kids deserve to get everything Obama's offering them to stay in America, and I really do believe that those idiotic NCLB provisions that haven't been working for a decade, there's no merit in enforcing them.
Topic number three.
Ohio's legislature recently approved Cleveland's ambitious school reform plan. What do these changes mean for schools in Fordham's home state?
Checker, is this a big deal or not? This is the Cleveland plan. The Cleveland mayor spent a lot of political capital getting through the legislature. There were big fights with the unions and with some charter school operators. So what emerged, and does it matter?
It matters less than it would matter if the mayor had really gotten his way and hadn't had to compromise so much. I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, Cleveland yesterday was at a 1 on any kind of a decent education performance or reform incentive or imperative. The mayor's plan, original plan, probably would have put it at an 8, and it's ended up around a 4 or 5 after all the compromising involved. That's still better than a 1, and it means that there are some opportunities coming open in Cleveland for quality control, for a portfolio approach to education, for some vetting of people and schools and authorizers that didn't exist before. But good grief, the fight that the mayor had with everybody in sight, even to get to a 4 or 5, was almost unforgivable.
So one of the exciting things in Cleveland, which may be a first, is that the mayor is saying he wants to share local revenue, level tax dollars with the charter schools.
High-performing charter schools.
With high-performing charter schools. And he wants to have some authority, some ability to shut down the low-performing charter schools, of which Cleveland has quite a few. That's where he ran into trouble with the charter school movement, at least some parts
of it. That's part of it. He also ran into trouble over who could authorize new charter schools in Cleveland and on what basis, and a whole variety of other things. But yeah, shutting down crummy schools, somebody's got to do it. And the authorizers in Ohio, by and large, have been irresponsible in this regard. And sharing revenues as an incentive for high performance and as a reward for high performance, right on. There's already a hint that Columbus may share some levy dollars with high-performing charter schools. So with any luck, the Cleveland mayor's plan is already beginning to prove contagious.
You know, Cleveland, famous for one thing, and has more charter authorizers than any other city in the country. At least we're pretty sure of that, with something like 9 charter school authorizers, of which Fordham is one.
And we are proud to be. We haven't been in Cleveland for long, but the school we are authorizing this coming year in Cleveland is shows every sign of being as terrific as the other ones operated by Breakthrough Schools.
Okay, that's all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Thanks for playing Checker. Now it's time for Amber's Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber.
Thank you, Mike.
All right, what you got for us this week?
No bantering when Checker's here, huh?
No, we just write down to business. He doesn't like to waste time, Amber. You know Checker.
This week, we've got a new report from NAEP that examines students' ability to perform both hands-on and interactive computer-based science tasks. First national assessment of its kind, so we know this is nationally representative samples of 4th, 8th, and 12th graders took the exam in 2009 as part of the NAEP science test. So this is sort of follow-up to the regular science test of NAEP. Students were asked to predict what might happen in a particular scientific scenario, make observations, and explain findings of the experiments they conducted. The tasks were based on real-life scenarios that scientists might encounter, such as which locations might be the best to build a new town based on water quality, which metal might be best when making a metal pan, considering how various metals conduct heat. Three key findings. First, the majority of students across grade levels were successful in making straightforward observations of data, so about 75 to 84% of students. So in other words, if they tested a water sample, they could tell you whether or not it met the EPA standard. Second, students struggle when investigations considered multiple variables to manipulate, such as manipulating various metal bars to determine which were magnets. So only about 25 to 35% of kids could manipulate such data. Third, and finally, students did a much better job selecting a correct conclusion, which I thought, because maybe it was multiple choice, 55 to 71% of students could do that. Then when they were asked to select a conclusion and then explain their conclusion with evidence. So only 15 to 54% across the grades could both select and then support their conclusion. Now, this is a funny part because we always then get to this additional sort of survey data, contextual data. You guys want to guess how many 4th and 8th graders said that they had teachers who did hands-on activities with them at least monthly?
I bet it's a lot.
Guess. We play along on this show.
64%.
92% of 4th graders and 98% of 8th graders.
Wow.
So you're like, what in the world are they doing if they can't then support a conclusion with evidence if they're actually doing these that often in these classrooms?
Monthly's not so very often. I'm not overwhelmed by this.
Well, if it's a block schedule, it's a lot.
Well,
you know?
Sure, if they're doing it for 5 consecutive hours once a month. Okay.
So anyway, that's kind of it. But I got to thinking about this is a random thought. Mm-hmm. But I got to thinking about the ELA standards and Common Core. And one of the big things they're asking students to do is use evidence from the text to support your conclusion or your reasoning. Just something that kids are lacking in the science.
But it strikes me that you could do all kinds of fun, hands-on science stuff, which might have its own value, but that does not necessarily get the kids talking about evidence or conclusions or what happened. I mean, I remember, you know, dissecting a frog.
Yeah, me too.
And frankly, I don't remember anything else. I mean, we dissected the frog and then that was sort of it.
I remember the parts of the frog. Like, I remember the naming, but yeah, in terms of explaining how those organs, yeah, right.
Frog's legs with garlic butter. Really good.
Yes. Did you dissect frogs back in the day?
I guess, way back. They had better frogs.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, Checker went to a boarding school, so they probably had premier frogs
right.
at his school.
I don't know.
Maybe they didn't smell as bad as the ones at our
yeah,
public schools.
They were bad.
All right. Well, yeah, this is Paul Gross wrote a piece for us on our blog. Paul is our longtime reviewer of state and now national science standards. And he said, look, people have been obsessed with hands-on science forever. Okay, there's always this perception that, you know, kids aren't doing enough hands-on science.
Mm-hmm.
That's what science educators love.
Yeah, they do.
And hey, some of that is worth doing, of course, but you can't learn anything from it unless there's knowledge that goes along from it.
Right.
Right.
Just what Dan Willingham says, too.
And E.D. Hirsch and everybody else.
Sense.
Right. You've got to have the knowledge base if you want to learn something.
But I have to say, because they have released all these items for teachers, I mean, I guess they're going to obviously have a whole new test next time. But I was impressed with these scenarios. You know what I mean? They were reasonable things that scientists could be feasibly contending with. They're not like silly, stupid things. I remember when I taught English, my prompt for my kids was, pretend you're moving to Mars. You know, what are you going to take with you and why? I'm like, come on, you know? So at least these scenarios were bound, you know, grounded in something a scientist could feasibly wrestle with.
I don't know how many scientists get to build new towns.
The water quality thing. I mean, I thought that was an important question.
All right. Fair enough.
Did you say magnet or maggot? a little while ago.
was that my southern accent? Did it sound like a maggot?
You talked about moving metal bars around to see which ones are maggots.
Be magnet.
Thank you.
The southern students would certainly do
southern
better.
Southern little twang might have messed that up. Whatever.
All right, that is all the time we have for this week. Until next week,
I'm Shugger Finn.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute's Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.